this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. The title of tonight's show, Cold Case Update. Hugo Fuegan is our guest. We are talking about The Fuddy Hoax. The Fuddy Hoax is the book that Hugo put together. Details, just in tremendous detail, all of the inconsistencies, the cover-up, from the official narrative to what the evidence actually shows, and it's a staggering difference between the two, as usual with how these things work. And the book, The Fuddy Hoax, is an extensive investigation into the Loretta Fuddy hoax.
Thanks, Joe. And I got to tell you, Hugo does a great job, doesn't he? Folks, you got to listen to this man. You got to... he goes into details like you can't believe. I want to thank Hugo in my absence for his all of his hard work. And I want to thank each and every one of you. So thank you so very much for everything you've done, all your prayers, your support, as my wife had taken ill last week and brought her home to our home today. Still in a lot of pain. You know how restaurants have what do you call it? Table turnover? I think hospitals have bed turnover. Anyway, nonetheless, she's still in a lot of pain, but thank you. But we came home today to a wonderful, wonderful box of Pro Flowers. And you talk about putting a smile on her face. Folks, have you forgotten an anniversary, or perhaps you know someone who's ill as well, or someone who just needs to have a smile put on their face? We've got something for you. Proflowers.com. We're going to make your life so easy for you. If you're shopping for that hard to find person, or if your wife needs that special pickup, or that special someone needs a smile, Proflowers.com, that's the place to go. Right now, Proflowers has a special offer just for Hagman and Hagman listeners. Get $10 off your purchase of $29 or more. That's right, $10 off, $29 or more. You can't beat it. This deal works on best-selling gifts like their 100 Blooms bouquet, which is, by the way, what my wife walked into. And, wow, the aroma. Oh, such a great aroma. A dozen red roses. Oh, are they beautiful as well. Or even their totally unique plant gifts. How about a bonsai tree? Have you thought about that? To snag this great deal, just go to proflowers.com, enter the code Hagman at checkout. Again, you know, my wife came in and she saw the box. She knew what it was. Big smile. And the aroma right where she's resting right now. It's just so fabulous. Proflowers, their bouquets are guaranteed to be fresh for 7 days or your money back. They've got a 7-step quality check, which means that the flowers are always awesome. Their website is super easy to use. You can schedule your delivery ahead of time, and you can select any date you want and just get back to your day. It's that easy. Guys, it's that easy. Proflowers is a no-brainer gift for birthday, anniversary, every occasion, even for no occasion at all. Those are the best kind, right? Am I right? Of course. Anytime when you want her to feel special. Proflowers, they take care of all the details. Now, do yourself a favor and help out our show by supporting Proflowers. I know you have, I know you got a birthday coming up or an anniversary or something special. Well, I know you do. So right now, get $10 off your purchases of $29 or more at Proflowers. But this deal definitely will not last long. So here's what you do. Go to proflowers.com, enter our code Hagman at checkout to get this special deal. That's proflowers.com, enter our code Hagman at checkout. Joe, I'll turn it back to you. And I just want to say thank you to everyone who had sent support. Tomorrow I'm going to be back in the saddle, by the way.
Fantastic. And again, thank you guys to all your emails of support, all your prayers. We can't tell you how much that means, and we thank each and every one of you for doing that. Back to our guest. We got Hugo Fuegan. He's the author of The Fuddy Hoax, and the website is soon to be coming. And again, if you want to order the book, info@thefuddyhoax.com. Send your contact information, and when they get the site up and running, you will be able to order your book, and they will reach out to you and let you know when that is. All right, Hugo, right before the break, we were, I believe you wanted to get to slide 5, and
yep.
I'll let you get right back into it.
Yes, let me make sure I understand that we, too, will be adding our prayers to Doug's wife's recovery.
Thank
you. But looking at slide 5, we see a depiction of what should have been possible with the actual flight. We have it confirmed by the takeoff video that at that red X, the aircraft was indeed about 1,000 feet. And with that kind of altitude and 15 knots of tailwind, there's no way in the world that that airplane should not have been able to make a safe landing back onto runway 5. If we look onto slide 6, we see another alternative, one that kind of incorporates the pilot's misrepresentation of being at only 300 feet when he was rounding the turn for Honolulu. So if he was a lot closer to the ground, this too would have been another option, which is what the pilots would call a teardrop entry into a downwind landing. That is, if he was very close to the ground, he could have turned directly for the runway and could have landed even with a tailwind onto that runway, which would have been far preferable than landing in the water. The people who were waiting ultimately 2.5 hours to be seen at a hospital could have been seen certainly within a half hour if the pilot had simply availed himself of the runway. Even if he had overshot the end of it, it would have been a far safer activity than putting the airplane in the water. But we know that his putting the airplane on the water, even a very perfectly good airplane onto the water, was the plan. So all these other alternatives really don't amount to much when we consider that it just wasn't the plan, even though it was quite possible. If you look at slide 7, we see another alternative that the pilot should have availed himself of, which is to land upwind. That is, he could have turned his craft directly without power upwind, and that would have probably meant a turn to the right. It could have been just as easily a turn to the left, and he could have put the aircraft onto the water in a headwind, which would have actually allowed for a 30-knot difference in the touchdown speed. But if we look at slide 8, we'll see two different things, two different slides. That is the last frame of the first portion of the video and the first frame of the second portion of the video. And we see something quite anomalous. That is, the sun's rays would have been going off 90 degrees to the airplane's heading in the first image there, but literally by its own evidence, we see the sun's rays appearing just on the very right edge of that window frame, which tells us where the sun was. That is, the pilot was flying almost directly into the sun. So he changed the direction of, or the relative position, orientation, if you will, of the aircraft 90 degrees. And doing that from that position doesn't make any sense at all. In fact, because, in part, he's turning away from the runway in doing that. That is, instead of going toward the runway, the pilot is shown to have flown the aircraft away from the runway and telling us implicitly that it was the plan to land on the water rather than put the airplane safely back onto the airport grounds, which he could have done in several ways, which were just mentioned. So anyway, there's that consideration and very strong evidence. That's depicted in slide 9, if you'll go there.
Okay.
We see the red X again, that first portion, the turn to Honolulu. And we know by other evidence very closely that the starting altitude of the second portion of the video was 255 feet, plus or minus 5 feet maybe. But we know where that was, and we know that it was into the sun's rays, which means it was headed toward the southwest there. So we know that at the start of the second video, the R is the location of that start. But why the pilot would have taken that diversion from the red X to lose 750 feet of altitude and fly away from the airport without availing himself of its safety is just amazing beyond anything that else could be said. We're left to believe he went directly between the X and D, but The video evidence makes clear it was between the R and D, which also, as I mentioned, tells us the pilot really did land the aircraft as slowly as possible in terms of ground speed, because he was headed directly into the wind. But to do that, he had to make a very strong diversion from the airport. Now, that diversion was, I think, 3/4 of a mile away, and intentionally lost that 750, even to 1,250 feet in altitude. So there's just no other way other than that the pilot had intended to land where he did, in the water. We can continue with the next slide. If we look at that, we can compare some facts, or some claims, if you will. The NTSB factual report says that the plane impacted the water in a wings level, slightly nose high attitude. Well, this is the very last frame before everything goes haywire and the plane hits the water. We can see that the plane is in more or less a 20 degree left bank. There is no way that this could have escaped a good NTSB investigator. The NTSB investigation made a critical mistake in misrepresentation. Apparently it was taken directly from what the pilot said, but they had evidence in hand that showed that the pilot was making a gross misrepresentation, and somehow our NTSB is unable to figure this out.
Or unwilling, which it seems to be the,
yes,
the case.
Yes, we'll get to that unwilling part. Yes, that seems pretty strong evidence. Furthermore, we can see by the mullions there and the inferred or implied longitudinal axis of the aircraft that it, in fact, was below the horizon. So he had a nose-low attitude and a left bank. And we see, actually, that the left main gear would have contacted the water first, which we'll also see that the seat that was closest to that attach point of the left main gear was actually thrown from the attachment, and it threw the passenger, who was an elderly lady from Illinois, it threw that passenger onto the floor, and actually apparently was the cause of several, I think it was 5 broken ribs and a split sternum. So the pilot doing this directly contributed to that passenger's severe injuries in that fashion. So this evidence shows what really happened, and it too is in divergence with what the NTSB puts in their report. Now, if we go to slide 11, we can see another misrepresentation by the NTSB report, which says the airplane landed within the open ocean water. And yet we see and can measure this in a number of different ways, with the wingspans of that very aircraft being 52 feet. We can make them go end-to-end and reach all the way to shore and see that the distance there is 702 feet, 13.5 wingspans of a Cessna Grand Caravan, which makes for 234 yards. And that's actually a confirming number, as other sight lines that we can draw on maps other ways. But the representation that that would be the open ocean water is a critical misrepresentation, especially as we look on the lower right map. There you see the bathymetry map that the NTSB included with their report, and the tip of the black arrow shows where the Cessna Grand Caravan put down in the water, and very near to that, within just 10, 15, 20 yards, we see an area of a circle with a 1 above it. That map legend tells us that that area was only 1 meter deep. It had the ocean floor was only 1 meter below the surface at that point.
And Hugo, if I can, just real quick with the open ocean, for people who are looking for, you know, a specific meaning, and they say there's a few different definitions, but all of them basically say the same thing. When you get technical about it, it says the ocean... open ocean is greater than 12 nautical miles from shore, And that's one definition. And another definition says that when it is in waters outside of the coast or outside of territorial regions. So I don't know what the NTSB definition of open ocean is, but regardless of what anybody's definition is, that is nothing near the open ocean.
That's quite correct. And there were very shallow waters throughout this area. If you look at that tip of the black arrow, you see a blue area all along the coast. That entire blue area was enclosing an area that was less than 10 meters deep. And if you look at numbers within that blue area, you see numbers like 4 1/4, 5 1/4, 2, 4, 1. There were very shallow areas. And as I say, the evidence of the left main gear touching down may indeed have contacted something on the ocean floor to have torn that seat away. And one of the passengers reported that the airplane came to an abrupt stop. If you're on the open ocean, this to me is like claiming the Universal Studios splash into the water, billowing water ahead of you and so forth, and it comes to a gentle gliding stop. But in fact, one of the passengers said it came to an abrupt stop. Now, with the very shallow waters at this point, one has to wonder whether there was not indeed some contact. There's a lot of evidence that suggests that. In fact, if you look at the actual aircraft in that upper right picture, that is the leftmost depiction of an aircraft, that shows that the right wing was down and the left wing was up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't happen in the open ocean. The open ocean would let the airplane settle symmetrically. Now, there might be an exception to that in terms of a so-called pontoon effect. If you had air trapped underneath the airplane, it could tip one way or the other. But in fact, we know that even though there was a baggage pod on this airplane, it was completely obliterated in the crash, and it was completely flooded with water. So it could not have accounted for a tipping type behavior. And there was immediately water rushing in both from the windshield and from the right rear door, which covered people's feet and ankles and other parts very quickly. So it could not have been the case that it would be tipping like that in an open ocean situation. So there's a lot of evidence to suggest, in fact, maybe that it was resting on the open ocean floor as it sat there. There's even more evidence than I've disclosed just yet, but we'll see that later, especially if you buy the book. If you look at the lower left image there in that frame, you see a Hawaii News Now news report excerpt that represents that the CEO of that commuter airline discussing that the plane crashed about a mile offshore. Now, the CEO should certainly know because he debriefed the pilot within hours after the plane crash. So he should have full well known exactly where that plane was. But the representation and even that picture appears to be of some kind of plane under maybe shallow water there out in the middle of the ocean. But if we go to the next frame, we'll see that enlarged a little bit, and we see, by golly, it kind of looks like a Cessna Grand Caravan. But if we go one frame further to 13, we are able to go to the original, that is the frame that was taken as a video image, and we see that it's not a Cessna Grand Caravan slightly underwater, but in fact it's a depiction of the U.S. Coast Guard Dolphin helicopter and its rotor downwash and rolling smoke from one of the smoke floats that the U.S. Navy put down toward the end of this scenario. So what we have here is one picture of actually a U.S. Coast Guard helicopter being portrayed as if it were the Cessna Grand Caravan out in the open ocean, which is, of course, more than misleading. It's a falsehood that's being pushed in that way. Not the last falsehood either. If we go to slide 14, we see two pictures, both of which originate with the NTSB, and we see the aircraft underwater. That is, it was part of the ditching video taken by the videographer. And we see that the lowest blade of that propeller has taken the brunt, probably, of the water's force as it came down onto the water. Unlike the blade at the upper right, which is seemingly not bent. But that lower one is bent such that it seems to contact the nose gear strut, which is a pretty strong bend of a couple, 2.5, 3 feet, something like that. But the airplane, when it was dredged up out of the water, is depicted there in a photograph at the right. And one has to ask the question, which of the propeller blades there that was bent backwards underwater was the propeller blade that we're looking at above water on the barge that salvage dredged up this airplane and its engine? So you see, none of those propeller blades are bent in that fashion, and I suggest everyone be able to understand and believe that propeller blades, once they're bent like that, do not unbend themselves by natural forces to look like they're all in the same prop disc that we see at right. So there's a huge problem with that, and frankly, the evidence is very strong that we have two different propeller blades, and if we have two different propeller blades, because of the difficulty of changing out a propeller blade or a propeller on the ocean floor, one has to think in terms of two engines. Now, why would there be two engines? And is there just this piece of evidence, or is there other supporting evidence of that?
And so
if
I can point out in your book, this is one area that's very detailed and documented. I'm not sure how many I haven't counted, but you do dedicate a lot of room to these the NTSB's reports and the photographs that they use versus what and you show the different ways, upside down, right side up, how this would fit with their photographs, and it is very detailed, and then you go to point out the anomalies and irregularities and what the conclusion of all this would have to be, and you do a very good job of detailing it and putting the photographs together. And there's a lot more in the book, folks, than what you're seeing here. So for those who are interested, keep that in mind.
We're whizzing right past everything. And if we look at evidence of the underwater versus the on-the-barge propeller blade tip paint scheme, that's a mouthful. But on top we see the engine sitting on the barge after it's been dredged up. And we look at that propeller blade tip paint scheme, and we make a comparison of that blade with all of the underwater frames, or several of the best ones. 8 underwater frames were grabbed and rotated and put beside one another and put in between that barge propeller blade tip paint scheme, and we see, frankly, they don't match, which is in fact supporting evidence that we're looking at two different propellers. And if we're looking at two different propellers, we're looking at two different engines. Now, the NTSB said that the airplane was found, or the engine was found, on the ocean floor already separated from its airframe. And it was separated in a fashion that they said was consistent with rolling around on a hard, uneven surface on the ocean floor. Now, that's, we're going to see, does that comport with the evidence? Again and again, I think we're going to see that that does not. In fact, it shows a misrepresentation on the part of the NTSB. So if you look at slide 23, there are actually three images there, and they all originate with an NTSB photo. The lower left is that photo, and you can see the right photo is an inset taken from it, and the upper left photo is an inset to one of the pictures we just saw of the three-bladed propeller on the barge deck. But at right, we see that there's a notch showing through the propeller blade. That is, there is a notch there. And through that notch, one can see that heavy ship's pipe showing through. Now, if one looks at the other side of that propeller blade, which we happen to have on the upper left, there's no notch there. So we cannot be looking at two sides of the very same propeller blade, which tells us there's a problem with these pictures. They are not consistent.
And Mr. Fugan, we're up against our break. Okay. Folks, we're talking with Hugo Fugan, and this is a fantastic interview going over the cold case of Loretta Fuddy, what really happened. And the book is The Fuddy Hoax, and we will have more information on the other side with Mr. Fugan, the upcoming website he's putting together, and how, folks, you'll be able to get the book right after these messages. Don't go anywhere.
Visit HagmanReport.com for the news and articles that matter most. Stay tuned. We will be right back. There
shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time. No, nor ever shall be.
Folks, I'm going to direct your attention to MasterPreps.com. MasterPreps.com. Wow. MasterPreps.com, the sponsor of our show, MasterPreps.com. That's MasterPreps.com. Take a visit there. High-quality items, made-in-America items. I mean, anything, everything you possibly want, from cooking utensils, cooking frying pans. It'll blow you away. Absolutely, Erickson.
It's insane. I mean, wow. Look at the products.
Folks, visit MasterPreps.com. Again, welcome to the Hagman and the Hagman Report family, MasterPreps.com. I mean, wow, it's insane.
MasterPreps.com. Are you ready for what comes next?
Hi, I'm Grace Gonzalez from Caring Close in the Woods. We are an American family-owned company founded and built on skills and knowledge gained from responding to 18 major disasters in the U.S. and around the world. We found that most people don't have enough food and water to survive, let alone any medicinals to save their life. We're offering 25% off our must-have American Heritage Hermes kit. It contains 12 homeopathic Hermes, a booklet that goes over everything in your kit, and our brand new book, Major Disasters Lessons Learned. Just enter coupon code HAGMAN. In life or a disaster, you must be able to take care of yourself. You may not be a medical doctor, and your grandmother and your great-grandmother probably weren't either, but they still knew how to minister to their family's health issues, and so can you. Check out our American Heritage Hermes Kit at www.changelessthewoods.com. Your life may depend on it.
Hello, everyone. This is Joe Charles, the guy whose voice is heard announcing for the Hagman and Hagman Report right here on YouTube and across the Global Star Radio Network. There have been many people wondering whose music is being played during those breaks. Well, you guessed it. And we're very pleased to announce that all that music and 11 brand new songs from the CD New Jerusalem is set for release on April 10th for download on iTunes. That means you can help support my ministry and be blessed by this awesome, inspiring recording. I have been fortunate to work with some phenomenal musicians from around the world that helped us put this recording together in the studio. Simply go to joecharlesmusic.com and click on the iTunes link. Or, if you'd rather have a CD, we'll send one right out to you. Just leave me your email and we'll get right back to you. And thanks to Doug and Joe Hagman for making this all possible. God bless.
this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. We are talking with Hugo Fugan. He is the author of The Fuddy Hoax, and in-depth detail into the investigation of Loretta Fuddy and the death and or what else might have happened. And we're going to get back with him in just a moment.
You know, Joe, Hugo has done such a great job in his book, him and other researchers. I've got to say that I went through the book with a fine-tooth comb and read everything, all the citations. What a fantastic work of investigation. And there is, I had a long way to be convinced, honestly, that there was that much amiss. And I could tell you without reservation, there is. And I am just absolutely pleased that Hugo is on, and I'm having the opportunity to listen to you and Hugo talk about this. And before you get back to Hugo, let me ask the people out there in business, are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Well, posting your job in one place is not enough to find quality candidates. Folks, if you want to find that perfect hire, you need to post your job on all of the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. You can find candidates in any city, any industry, nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's very easy-to-use interface. We've used this interface. It is just so amazing. It makes hiring so much easier. No more juggling emails. No more calls to your office. You can quickly screen quality candidates. You can rate them. You can hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
All right, getting right back into the show, we're speaking with aviation expert and author Hugo Fugan. And just so you folks have an understanding of who Hugo is, he's not just a citizen journalist. Hugo has logged over 2,500 hours of flight experience and over 450 hours as a certificated instrument and flight instructor. Mr. Fugan holds a single engine land and multi engine land commercial certificate, class 2 medical, as well as a certificate for his experimental Landcare 320, which he's been flying for more than 27 years. Also has been a successful CEO and president of over 3 different aviation simulation regulated companies, and has a much more extensive professional history than that. Back to you, Mr. Fugan.
Okay. We can go to slide 24.
All right.
Let me be clear, by the way. I have a co-author who is an incredible researcher, and none of this book could have been put together without her help. And her name is Nellie Ristvedt, and we together have done the research behind this book, and never could have been done without her. But moving ahead, slide 24, if we could ask the tech to bring that up. We have essentially the same image as we had a moment ago, but this time we're looking at so-called edge jaggies of a photograph. That is, a digital photograph always has what they're called jaggies. That is, where there are edges, there are digital changes from one color to another, and those can be, when zoomed in greatly, you can see those discrete changes. And they are very smooth when you see it at a normal resolution, but when you go in a little bit, you begin to see these so-called jaggies. And if we look at that frame at the right, we can look at the tips of the yellow arrows and see kind of what the definition is of those jaggies. But if we look at the two red arrows, we see that between the two white painted stripes on that propeller blade, the jaggies are rather coarse. And that kind of an artifact would occur when you take an image from one photograph, that's say of a lower resolution, and you put it in an image of a higher resolution. So what we're looking at is a contrast between different resolutions as evidenced by the jaggies. And these jaggies give away that that propeller blade image, particularly the paint scheme on the tip, is different than the rest of the picture. And there's a lot more evidence about that because we're trying to discover how to account for differences we've seen. If we move to slide 25, we see that other barge blade image that we used as a comparison for the underwater blades, at top to compare against the NTSB blade image, and we see a big difference, that black space between the two painted portions is much wider at top than at bottom. So how can that be? Because the truism that on all modern propellers, all of those blades have the exact same paint scheme. It's very important that they do. And we see at left on that frame, at that slide 25, there's a picture of this very aircraft on the ramp. And we can see that paint scheme. And we can see that it matches the upper picture, and it does not match the lower picture. So there's strong evidence that the upper one is the correct one. But if we move to the next frame, the next slide, we find there are two other images that I was able to get from other media sources of that very same propeller tip paint scheme that is represented in the NTSB photograph. And we see that they match the barge blade tip paint scheme and the one that we saw on the ramp just a moment ago. So we see which one is correct. And we see that the difference was adopted by the NTSB, but it's in fact a Photoshop fraud. So we don't just have misunderstandings by the NTSB. We don't have overlooked evidence by the NTSB. We don't have misrepresentation of the evidence by the NTSB. We have falsified evidence by the NTSB, which, of course, deserves to be rewarded with an appropriate reward, probably. I think Donald Trump has called it draining the swamp. We might need to divert the Potomac to flush all of that to get to the proper level, not just drain it, but that is, you'd be left with a lot of sludge if you just did that. But the long and the short is our NTSB, which are looked at as the cream of the crop, tippy top of the best, no hint of incompetence anywhere. That's the reputation. But we have all of these problems, not just overlooked evidence, not misrepresentation, but literally falsification. And I think these slides prove it. That is, that blade tip paint scheme was changed. And the reason it was changed was because I had shared, better not say exactly why, but we'll juxtapose these two things. I had shared with the investigator in charge that I suspected that there were two engines involved in this scenario, and that one indicator of that being true was this underwater, above water blade tip paint scheme comparison, which showed that there were two different blade tip paint schemes. And I think we can go to slide 22. If we take the NTSB blade tip paint scheme and use it to compare the underwater paint scheme, coincidentally, they seem to match. So that if I infer, which is a little bit of speculation, which I shouldn't do probably, but my inference is nonetheless that it was evidence changed to match the underwater blade tip comparison, which might negate the evidence that I had brought to the NTSB that there were in fact two engines. So that's my conjecture about that, but I think it's reasonably well founded. Anyway, we'll move on. Let's move on to slide 28. one of the representations by the NTSB, as if to account for, in some sense, the Fuddy death that's claimed, Fuddy is represented as having an infant life jacket. Mm-hmm. And an infant life jacket that had only one of its chambers filled, that is, one of the CO2 cartridges, and there were two, one of those was still full, consistent with a partially inflated life vest. So their claim is that she had an infant life vest and that it was partially inflated. But if we look at the video evidence that the videographer has coincidentally, fortunately provided, in the upper left corner, we see fully inflated life jacket on Ms. Fuddy. And furthermore, its silhouette and its representation from several angles is that it does not match an infant life jacket. That is, there was another person who happened to put on an infant life jacket. He was a former Green Beret. And the two pictures at the upper right, the smaller pictures there, show that infant life jacket, which appears rather round. There's actually three frames in which it appears. And we can see lines drawn by comparison saying that it seems not to match or it does match. But anyway, it's smaller, it's roundish, and if you look from underwater in the rightmost middle, we see it's kind of thinnish from the bottom. And that's what a, I believe that's a single chamber infant life jacket filling. That's what that looks like. But that is very different from what we see on Ms. Fuddy. Ms. Fuddy, in the lower picture there, lower left, her life jacket, fully inflated, looks very much like two other life jackets that are shown there, both above and to the right. So the very strong evidence that Ms. Fuddy had a fully inflated adult life jacket, it's hard to say anything else. That is, it cannot be. That is, once both the upper and the lower chambers are filled, that CO2 cartridge that was claimed to be still full actually tells us something, I think, about someone actually having changed out one of the CO2 cartridges to be full. And that is a huge problem. And it says as well, a representation by the NTSB is that when Ms. Fuddy was taken aboard the U.S. Coast Guard helicopter, that an infant life jacket was cut from her. So we have these two facts, an infant life jacket being cut from Ms. Fuddy and that there was a CO2 cartridge that was still full. This cannot be. Either one of those cannot be. We have evidence to the contrary. Did someone steal her life jacket while she had a fully inflated adult life jacket, take it from her and swap it with a partially inflated infant life jacket? That, hey, we don't see that on the video. We don't see it at all. We don't see that happening. So who would have done that? And it might suggest someone is trying to do her harm. But in fact, I think this this partially inflated infant life jacket is mentioned in the official narrative as if it accounts for a stress level on Ms. Fuddy that might have caused her to hyperventilate, which coincidentally is the ultimate cause of death that's mentioned by the medical examiner. So this ultimate cause of death is fraught with a lot of evidentiary contradiction, and it's very hard to see how this could have happened naturally. That is, it looks like human hands again at work changing the official narrative from what it really was, and for which there's a lot of evidence. And the NTSB blithely reports these things as if there's no counter evidence. So that's a big issue, that the NTSB, on whom we rely, can't seem to figure this out. When the NTSB goes to court and says, this is what we found, I don't know if there's a single court case ever that has been able to overturn what the NTSB has found in a thorough investigation. So what we're looking at is a corruptible process that is totally at odds with the NTSB's reputation. And unless this is fixed, we have people that are clearly committing criminal acts within the NTSB or wherever those were changed. I, by the way, made a FOIA request for the chain of custody documents on these so-called accident photos. And it's been over 9 months where this is supposed to be, a FOIA request like that is supposed to be answered within 10 business days. It was never answered. I called to follow after it several times, and I was told that as soon as the investigator in charge releases it, they could, but that wasn't happening. And it's now over 9 months. So, in fact, I believe this would probably show major embarrassment, if not worse, among the people at the NTSB, because these things are a problem.
Yeah, and they don't want that.
No.
You know, there's been a lot of questionable things that the NTSB have been involved in. But this, to me, from what I've seen you put together from your book, The Fuddy Hoax, is one of the most, if not the most, in-depth investigation into one of these events where you actually point out what's reported versus how it is not able to be accurate, and then posting the truth. You have so much evidence in this book, and I don't want to knock every stride, Hugo, but I just want to let you know we have about 9 minutes before the end of our interview. And my father's in studio, obviously wasn't here for the interview, but he wants us to bring you back soon so we can do a part two to this update, okay. And he wants to be present, so just as an FYI.
Well, I look forward to that. So I'll try to keep that in mind and as much as I'm able to craft things into some kind of a conclusion in that time. I'll try to do so, but I'm doubtless going to fail. Anyway, let me try to just move quickly and we'll gloss over a few things. Let me move to slide 29. And we see possible further falsification of evidence. And I'm not prepared to say who made that the falsification, but what we see in the recorded video is a silent period, 6 seconds of silence at the beginning of the ditching video. And at the end of that 6 seconds of silence, there's as if on a flip of a switch, the engine magically starts rotating, not in a winding up fashion, but as if on a switch at over 15,000 RPM. Now, I think that's a physical impossibility. Physics don't allow anything of such mass to begin turning in a hundredth of a second or 10 milliseconds or whatever. So that cannot have happened. And coincidentally, if we look at the audio track at that point, we see there's a telltale glitch pointed to by those two red arrows, which suggests very strongly that two sections of audio were electronically spliced together. So that's a telltale sign that should be a problem, because that engine must have been running the entire time. Now, elsewhere we'll see that the pilot says he made 2 engine restarts, but there's no indication of that whatsoever, and it completely contradicts the idea that the engine was running throughout, for which there is evidence. And I think, in fact, the video was also run throughout, probably, and is just spliced into 2 separate pieces, with the middle part gone missing. But anyway, these telltale signs tell us there's lots of problems between the official narrative and what the actual evidence shows. And one of those, and let me try out this audio thing. If we can get your tech there to play audio A17, we're going to hear the engine running smoothly and, in fact, rising in its RPM. Now, we're told that this had a catastrophic failure and stopped. And the NTSB and Pratt & Whitney Canada, the engine manufacturer, tore this engine down and they saw that there was an intense internal fire in that engine that must have occurred after the catastrophic engine failure on the way down to the water. But this is what we hear, if we can play that segment.
All right. No, the audio's not coming through. For some reason, the... Hold on, let's try it again. Did you hear that, Hugo?
No, I was unable to hear it, but I know what it sounds like.
Okay.
Were you able to hear that rising RPM?
Yeah. Yeah, that kind of high pitch.
Okay. Yeah. If we can play A05 as an audio clip for just a moment, okay, we'll hear the narrator say something about the crash. So right after the crash, we're going to hear that engine RPM change, which sounds like it's the power lever being retreated. So let's hear that.
Okay.
Listen closely.
It's a remarkable, remarkable video. Take a look.
All we heard on that one, Hugo, was it sounded like a newscast saying it was a remarkable, remarkable video. Take a look.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But in the background, hopefully you heard the very loud engine running. Did you hear that?
We'll play it one more time. Here we go.
Very loud.
It's a remarkable, remarkable video. Take a look.
Yeah. You could hear that kind of humming noise.
Yeah. And there's nothing else it could be. Now if we could play A21, that's the one that says the plane is about to crash, which has that reduction of RPM.
Plane is about to crash.
Oh, yeah. You're going,
Yeah. Now, what else in the airplane could possibly make that sound? There is nothing else.
Okay. I got to take your word for that. Cause.
Yeah. Well, we should listen for a moment to A14. We're going to hear the engine as it contacts the water. Now, what would happen if a running engine did that? And what would happen if there's no engine running because it had stopped? A14 tells us.
Okay, that was a high-pitched sound, and then it...
Somehow turned into zero RPM. Want to try it again just in case?
Sure. Okay, it sounded like a switch was flipped or something.
Yeah, well, it was running at 15,000 RPM plus, and then all of a sudden, when it ingests a huge amount of water, it's not going to run at all. And that time it takes to do that is just a couple hundred milliseconds.
Interesting. And folks, this is some fascinating stuff. Again, we're reviewing the cold case of into the death or disappearance of Loretta Fuddy, who is, you know, the person hired under Abercrombie to deal with the release of the Obama birth certificate. And we have 2 minutes left, Hugo, just as an FYI.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, I probably shouldn't try to wind things up, but let me just show you a few anomalous things. In number 32, slide 32, we're going to see that the elderly couple has non-official life jackets on that were not known to be with the aircraft. The wife is wearing this life jacket that appears to have a 20-inch phallus on it and allows her to be seated in the water. And the husband has a belt-type life jacket, which is not shown in the NTSB collection of life jackets, and in fact is not part of the supplies of a standard commuter airline of this type.
So they would have to bring these or pick them up somewhere else or been given them?
Yeah.
Okay.
They were given them, and in fact that the one given the wife is in fact an electronic device. it shows that we're, what we're dealing with is an underwater network of communications where she's sporting an antenna that's kept above the water. If we see the upper right image, she's keeping that 20-inch phallus right above the water so it can communicate with an aircraft that we know is overhead. So anyway, there's amazing stuff there. If you look in slide 33, we see the top four images are of a helmet. The person at the right front seat in the airplane is wearing a helmet, which is acknowledged by one of the other passengers in testimony to the police, by the way.
Wow.
In the lower left, we see there's a black box on Loretta Fuddy's left hip, which just could not have occurred naturally in any sense. And it sounds like we're going... Anyway, the lower right image is one of another device that another passenger has that looks like it's an inflation-deflation device.
Yeah, and there's so many of these photos that Hugo has put together. Hugo, I want to thank you so much for coming on. We will talk this week, and we will get you scheduled to come back on as soon as possible to go over the rest of the material you have, because you have such an extensive collection of material that you put together in the book, The Fuddy Hoax. I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a very fascinating show, and we look forward to having you back on.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Folks, we'll be right back with Sheila Zielinski after these short messages. Don't go anywhere.
Just what kind of thriller predicts the future? In 3 days in the Belly of the Beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God Particle before CERN actually discovered the God Particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest-yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high-net-worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.